This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk with Stephen Schlesinger, the son of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the great historian of the 20th century. The book that Stephen is talking about is The Letters of Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Those letters are full of personal, political, and historical insights into the tumultuous events and enormous personalities that dominated his time, including correspondence with the likes of Bill Clinton, Henry Kissinger, and Lauren Bacall. Also on the show, Ray Strother, the well-known political consultant, advisor to Bill Clinton, Gary Hart, Buddy Romer, and many others. He'll talk about what's going on contemporaneously and the outcome of the budget battle on Capitol Hill, and we'll visit with Ray Strother. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. By email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin with political consultant Ray Strother, former president of the American Association of Political Consultants, chief advisor to the likes of Bill Clinton, Gary Hart, Russell Long, Buddy Romer, a member of the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame and the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame, and the author of two outstanding books, one his autobiography, Falling Up, How a Redneck Helped Invent Political Consulting, and the other, a fabulous novel about politics, Cottonwood. Joining us from Montana is Ray Strother. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim.
And you were in Baton Rouge last week.
Last night.
Well, you had a good time, I'm sure, at the Manship School, along with Dean Jerry Seppas.
Old friends like you and other people and people around journalism. It was a great time.
Well, in higher education right now, the Manship School is thriving, but it's a difficult time in Louisiana, and the New York Times has taken note of this in Saturday's editorial pages. The newspaper of record says under Governor Bobby Jindal, Louisiana has been slashing state support for higher education, with funding for Grambling State University down 56% since 2008, and for funding for public colleges in general down 48%. What's going on?
What's going on is raw, pure, ugly politics. It's a great shame that to pay for a tax increase, which was good politics for conservatives around the nation, he had to sacrifice education. That's how he paid for his tax cut. So he cut the taxes. That made a lot of conservatives happy around the country and probably forwarded his resume when he runs for president or tries to run for president. I don't think it'll happen. But he paid for it with poor Grambling and LSU and Northwestern State and all the state schools. It's terrible. Well, education has to be at the top of the priority list for any society, any state. And that was the place he chose to rob to pay for his political ambitions.
Well, funding for Grambling is down to $14 million a year, $13.8 million actually. Louisiana Tech is about $20 million, I think. These schools are being forced to operate on tuition, and that only goes so far in a poor state like Louisiana.
Yeah, these are state schools, not private schools. Northwestern State even had to eliminate its Department of Journalism because they couldn't afford it. A whole part of the curriculum gone simply because of somebody's political ambition. I think it's a great shame and a scandal.
Well, today in the Baton Rouge Advocate, it says LSU's Baton Rouge campus has absorbed $120 million in cuts of about $700 million that has been slashed over the last several years. Why would higher education be on the chopping block? Is it because it's the only place to cut, or is this designed to starve universities in some ways? What do you think?
You know, I can't imagine anyone would want to starve universities, so I'm going to give all the political people a benefit of a doubt there. I think it's just the largest pot of money that you can look and see immediately, and it is a lot of money. And before the cuts happened, it wasn't enough money. Most of our universities weren't funded as they should have been before that. So I think it's just a way that you can affect the least, fewest number of voters. College students tend not to be involved in the political process quite yet. The fact is, staff, if you take all of them together, are a small percentage of the voting population. So it might just be the way that you can grab money and offend the fewest number of people, I guess. However, it doesn't say anything about sacrificing the future.
297-5633, if you would like to join the conversation with Ray Strother, who came to Louisiana State University and became at one time, I think it's fair to say, the top political consultant in the United States. You've noted that when you went to Washington many years ago, there were a handful of firms doing
right.
what you did. And now you go down any street in Washington and you're likely to find a political consulting firm.
Well, the great statistic there is, Jim, is when I moved to Washington, I only had one Democratic firm in competition with me, and there were one or two Republican firms. And I looked at the roster of the American Association of Political Consultants membership, and it's over 2,000.
2,000, my goodness. Well, yesterday, John Kennedy, the state treasurer, I don't know if he's ever been a client of yours or not. I don't think so. But
we've talked many times, but no, he's never been a client.
Okay. Well, he's a really good watchdog on state spending, but he didn't want to get critical of a $2 million expenditure for a gubernatorial center for Mike Foster's papers in Franklin that will cost the state $2 million. Now, there's nothing like this for Buddy Romer or for Edwin Edwards or for Kathleen Blanco or any other governor. But Bobby Jindal, who, of course, was brought to the dance by Governor Foster as a 24-year-old cabinet secretary in 1996, he's all for this. And John Kennedy, who's been taking aim at these non-governmental organizations, is unwilling to criticize this expenditure. Is it really a good thing, or should it be funded through private contributions? What do you think about this gubernatorial center?
I think, Jim, that's a no-brainer. First of all, there are a lot of universities in the state that could house papers of a two-term governor. Been a lot of two-term governors, and I think it'd be a shame to spend state money on something like that. It'll end up 20 years from now being trivial, because 20 years from now, no one will ever know who Mike Foster was, to be quite honest with you. And whether he was a good governor or not really doesn't matter. Like, when I was down there, someone was asking me that with the, you know, to rank governors in my time. And I thought the first term of Edwin Edwards was a great milestone. I thought he was a great governor in the first term. But everybody overlooks John McKithen. You know, people look at you blankly. Who? And so that's what's going to happen to Mike Foster. And I think McKithen was far, far more productive than Foster. So to spend state money on something mm-hmm. like that is, I think, a great shame. I'm sure Mike Foster has and deserves a lot of friends who would help him. I'm sure he helped a lot of people when he was governor. They should build a museum, not the state.
Well, since Ray brought up Edwin Washington Edwards, Kevin, do we have that cut from a few days ago? Edwin Edwards, of course, has been making a few appearances in connection with the debut of his reality show with his wife, Trina, the governor's wife, and last Friday, at the Lod Cook Center, I had the pleasure of being with the former governor who served our state 16 years, and he's 86. He'll be 88 next time there's an election, and there's some question as to whether he legally could run. But he says, the governor says, former governor, that he is considering the prospect of seeking the state's highest office once again in 2015, when he will be 88 years old.
Lately, for some strange reason, it's beginning to think like it might be a nice thing to do. But I'm not going to make the decision based upon that. I'm going to make the decision based upon whether I think I can win, and if there's a need for me, because I don't want to end what I consider to be a successful political career on a sad note. But I love this state, and I think I can do better than has been done. And if I saw the opportunity and I thought that people would warm up to it, I would consider.
Do you think this state needs you?
What's that?
Does the state need your leadership?
Well, you never ask a politician something like that. I mean,
all right, that's Edwin Edwards. Admittedly, that's a softball. Does the state need you? Of course, he says, of course the state needs me. Does the state need Edwin Edwards at 88 years old?
Look, if he could do the job, I'd say yes. 2 years ago, when he was just out of the federal institution and hyping his new book, I attended a Kiwanis meeting with him and sat with him on the head table. And so they asked him to speak about Louisiana's problems and how to solve them. And he got up without a note and was literally brilliant. It was one of the more brilliant things I've heard on how to solve the economic problems and how to fund the important things like education. And I was wowed. I was just, I'd forgotten how very good he was. And at that point, he didn't seem to have lost a single step. So 88, maybe at 88 he'd be better than a lot of people I can think of that 44. So let's not discount.
Well, he was 44, as was Romer when they were elected governor. And as I reminded him, 88 is 44 times 2. So maybe it's 88 and in the gate for Edwin Edwards. But when he was asked about whether he could legally run, of course he could run if he received a presidential pardon. But he claims, and I think he's right, that this law that was passed that requires 15 years to go by after serving the time, that to go by before a person can run again, that it was passed after he was convicted. So he claims that this excludes him and that he would be able to run if he so chose, and that he is weighing that prospect. How seriously, I don't know, but Edwin Edwards is one of those people, usually when he says something, he means it to be repeated. And he obviously said that he is considering a run for governor of Louisiana. And I reminded him that there already is another Democrat named Edwards in the race, in John Bell Edwards. And he said if John Bell was a viable candidate, and he might be, that he would step aside. But at this point, there are very few people. This is my statement. At this point, there probably are not that many people in the state who know who John Bell Edwards is. Can a Democrat win in Louisiana anymore, Ray Strother, whether it's Edwin Edwards or John Bell Edwards or anybody else?
It'll take an exceptional Democrat to win in any statewide office in the South, not just Louisiana. Louisiana lagged behind the rest of the South, and it's moved to the right, and it's moved to Republicanism. But now Louisiana is as Republican as Mississippi or Alabama, or even Georgia. So it'd be tough. Now, you could have the exceptional person, and I've never bet against Edwin Edwards ever. I mean, I've learned not to anyway, let's say that. But you could have an exceptional circumstance or person, because remember, people and parties don't get elected, not parties. People get elected. But anyway, it could happen, but very unlikely to elect a Democrat in the Deep South. Very, very hard. You know, Mary Landrieu is the last standing statewide Democrat in Louisiana, is she not?
Yes, she is.
Yeah.
Statewide, yes.
Yeah, so.
And she's got a tough battle next year.
Yeah, and I've watched this all over the South, watched Democrats lose seats and lose elections, and I see no chance of it abating for the moment.
Including your friend in Georgia.
Yes, my dear friend Roy Barnes, you know, one of the great men I've ever met in American politics, was beaten, and now the governor there is in all sorts of legal entanglements, but he was during the election. And we did a focus group to show how pervasive this is. We did a series of focus groups with women trying to find out what they really thought about the two candidates. And so this our opponent was named Deal, and we would lay out his ethical problems and crimes, et cetera. And they would say, my God, he's a crook. But then you'd ask, well, who are you going to support? The crook. Why? He's a Republican. I mean, that's all that mattered. So that's a good indication of what's happening all over. Now, demographics are changing some. Florida's becoming Democratic again simply because of Hispanics moving into the state. Texas is slowly becoming Democratic again. And Georgia may also.
Hold that thought. We'll return with Raymond Strother, and we'll talk about politics here and there when we come back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, 877-217-5757, or Inkstershow at WRKF.org. Ray Strother, the political consultant extraordinaire, is with us, joining us from Bozeman, Montana. Glenn on St. Philip. Glenn, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. Mr. Strother, just a question. When you talk about the Democrat having a hard time swinging the South, and maybe you want to ask this question about Texas. There seems to be a lot of talk about the changing demographics in Texas, and the Democrats are looking at Texas as a state they can get and pick off, and it will become Democrat. I'm just curious as to your take on that.
I've predicted for a long time that Texas will fall back into the Democratic Party. I did a lot of work in Texas. I represented Lloyd Benson for many years, and Lloyd Doggett and Martin Frost and a lot of people in Texas. And I watched it drift away from us, particularly after Benson left the Senate. But now I begin to see signs that it's coming back, and a lot of it's changing demographics. I don't think Texas will come back in the next presidential race, but I think 4 years past that or 8 years past that, it probably will.
That would change a whole lot of things. It certainly is hard for a Republican to win the presidency right now, Ray Strother. Five of the last six elections have been won by Democrats in the popular vote, and then you take Texas off the board, which has the second most electoral votes. It would seem the Republican Party would either have to move more to the middle or more to the left or move out of the presidential sweepstakes.
Well, that's what's happening. They're doing it to themselves. They're alienating Hispanics. They're alienating African Americans. They're alienating women. What's going to be left? A lot of old white men can't elect the president of the United States. There just aren't enough of us, and so they're shooting themselves in the foot. And I don't know if they'll ever wake up to it, because every time I hear Cruz speak as a Democrat, I have great satisfaction.
But that said, in states like Louisiana, it is a wasteland right now for Democrats running for office. And
it is.
And this is serious stuff with Edwin Edwards. If he somehow can get in the race, I think he can make a runoff. I don't think he can win, but I think he can make a runoff. What would happen if Edwin Edwards got in a runoff for governor with David Vitter?
You know, I just don't have any idea. I would guess that Vitter would win. Age would become a factor. I remember when I did John Stennis' last race in Mississippi many years ago. The only factor, everybody loves Stennis. The only factor was age. So we had to keep the campaign pointed in another direction. We never allowed age to become an issue. So age would become an issue with Governor Edwards, I'm sure. Senator Vitter, I just don't know a lot about him, except he has one great advantage, and he's a Republican, and he's known statewide, which gives you a real leg up. Here's the problem. If you're a Democrat running the South and people think Democrats can't win, they don't contribute to Democrats, and money runs politics. Money's the single most important element in American politics. If you can't raise the money to run, you can't win. Very seldom does someone get elected without having parity with their opponent in money.
And as a political consultant, I'm sure you would expect that if it were Vitter versus Edwards, that the personal failings of each man would be in full bloom on the radio, on television, in newspapers, on the internet. We would have a race that would be R-rated.
It would be. It'd be a messy affair. And I think the next governor's race will be a messy affair anyway, if the Democrats come up with enough money to field a candidate, even if it isn't Edwin. I think it's going to be very messy.
HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on the air with Ray Strother.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Ray, do you think that this country would be better off if we did away with the Electoral College process on national elections and strictly with the voter turnout, and get more people to come to the polls if their word alone decide who was going to be elected? Thank you, sir.
You've hit my sweet spot. I think the Electoral College is a huge error. I went to China one time with a State Department group to talk to them about democracy, how it worked. And this Chinese kid raised his hand, says, and I made a statement that the person with the most votes wins. And he raised his hand quizzically, said, always? This was just after the Bush-Gore election. And I had to stop short and say, oh, how am I going to explain this? Try to explain the Electoral College to a Chinese citizen who's trying to study democracy. It's almost impossible. We got to get rid of the electoral system, but I don't see it happening.
Back to higher education for a moment. The president of LSU, King Alexander, he's gotten rave reviews in his first few months. He can give a speech. He's an eloquent man, and he gave up a nice job to come this way. But yesterday at the Baton Rouge Press Club, he more or less defended the LSU Board of Supervisors for not releasing the names of those who had applied along with him for the position. He said that he was guaranteed confidentiality, and this is how he responded as far as how he thought the process would go or not go if he had not been given that guarantee. King Alexander yesterday at the press club. Kevin says we're going to have to wait on this one, but he says that he would not have applied. He would not have applied for the job if he had not been given confidentiality. Now, Mark Emmert applied when he was president of the University of Connecticut, chancellor of Connecticut, in 1999, and he was listed as a finalist. Why are these leaders of higher education so sensitive about it being known that they might be seeking employment elsewhere?
Well, a lot of people blink when the lights turned on. I think it's just human nature to want to cover yourself. The best of all worlds is have a very secure job and try to get another one without anyone knowing about it, so therefore you don't damage yourself at home. I could sort of understand that, but one must remember we live in a society with the First Amendment in the Constitution. And the public, you know, funds LSU, it funds the state institutions, and they have a right to know what's going on there. So I'm an advocate, complete advocate of completely opening the shades on every window and letting all the light in. People have a right to know everything.
And Judge Janice Clark now has possession of those names. She was fining the board $500 a day until they coughed up the names, and ultimately they gave the names to her, pending court action. And we may at some point find out who did apply, but it is commonplace now, apparently, that applicants for these positions are not revealed, and it's done by a headhunting firm. This firm does work all over the country, and they guarantee, I don't know if they have the authority to do it, but apparently they guarantee people like King Alexander that his name will not be revealed unless he's hired. In this case, Ray Strother, it appears they may have made a guarantee that they did not have the authority to do.
Yeah, it does appear that way. And, of course, you know why they do that. It's better for their bottom line. They get more people to participate. It's a complicated problem. I can understand both sides. I can understand a guy at the University of Oklahoma being offered a job at LSU and wanting to toy with it, but losing both ways. If he doesn't get the job at LSU and people at Oklahoma get angry with him because he tried to leave Oklahoma, then he's in trouble. So I can sort of understand both sides. But I always come down on freedom of information.
Here we go. Here's King Alexander, Press Club, Monday, October 28th, 2013.
I certainly was, actually, from the search firm, because, and I wouldn't have taken this opportunity or this chance, leaving my board members and leaving my donors and leaving all the students back in California.
All right, that's King Alexander saying he would not have applied. I ran this cut by a few people at LSU yesterday afterward, and a few said he's right, a few said he's wrong, and a few said he's put in a spot where he can't very well criticize the people who hired him, so he might be fibbing a bit. So.
Well, he's not going to come out against the Board of Supervisors and anger the Board of Supervisors. I know that for sure. Only a fool would do that, and obviously he's an extraordinarily intelligent man, so I'm not surprised at that.
The Mary Landrieu race next year. Now, according to political insiders like Charlie Cook, is leaning slightly Democratic. Landrieu has had three bruising elections for the U.S. Senate, and she's up for number four next year. She has an unpopular Democratic president, unpopular in Louisiana, who could bring her down, but Landrieu, according to the political insiders, now is a slight favorite over Bill Cassidy and Rob Manus. So what do you think?
I think it'll be a very difficult race, and not because of Senator Landrieu, but it'll be a difficult race because of the trends in the South and the trend in Louisiana. She may win, but it'll be one of those late-night elections, in my opinion. It'll be very tough. People know her, however, and she has a good base in Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and she has a very influential brother, and I think that'll help her a lot. She has complete name recognition, so she has a lot of advantages. Her disadvantage, of course, is she's running with a president that's not, or running under the flag of a president who is not well-liked in Louisiana, and she's running as a Democrat, which Democrats are not well-liked in Louisiana at the moment. So I would guess, if I were betting in Vegas, I'd bet that Mary Landrieu would be reelected, but it would be very close.
You know, at this stage in her career, she's been in the Senate, will have been for 18 years. She was in the Louisiana House for 8 years. She was state treasurer for 8 years. So that's 34 years of public service. She could cash it in, become a high-paid lobbyist, make far more money as a lobbyist than she does as a U.S. senator. What keeps a person like her going?
You know, I wouldn't even want to get into that because I wouldn't want to insult Mary or anybody else. Part of it's ego. People, of course, public service is a fine thing, and a lot of people serve because they think they're doing a great public service. A lot of them serve simply because it somehow is good for their ego to hold office. And I have seen a few politicians who had enough. I talked to Alan Simpson one time, and Alan Simpson, the great Republican senator from Wyoming, stepped down. Lloyd Benson stepped down. Sam Nunn stepped down. All my clients stepping down. I wonder if that has anything to do with me. But anyway, not that Simpson was a client, but I was with him at Harvard. But it's an exception when people step down. And what's interesting, Simpson told me one time that he stepped down because he hated what Washington had become. Just some of the things you mentioned, people who cash in on lobbying, the bickering between political parties, the wild accusations. It's just an ugly business now, and some of these people quit because of that. I don't know why Senator Landrieu would stay there, quite honestly. It's a tough life. People think they go up there and it's an easy life. It isn't. They work pretty hard. And, you know, if I were Senator Landrieu and her husband, Frank, I think I'd reconsider.
Really?
Sure.
Really? Well, she
served a long time.
Yeah, she's born in 1955, so next year she'll be 59 years old by the time the election rolls around.
And I've known her since she was a child because I worked for her father.
Well,
so it's so strange to me. It's this three-term senator.
And she went straight, and I'm not being whimsical, it's exactly what happened. She went straight from her sorority house at LSU to the Louisiana house
right
when she's out of school, and 34 years in government is a long time, but she's gotten to know the wheels of power and how they churn and turn, and she has an advantage in that she has some seniority, and she knows what's going on, and she wants to keep the job, and I think
well,
she'll...
Let me give her another asset. Can anyone think of any ethical problem that Mary Landrieu has had in the Senate or as treasurer? I mean, there's virtually none. She's run a spotless administration wherever she has been. Mm-hmm. And so her integrity should bode well for her. That's, you know, when you could do the assets and the minuses, that would definitely be an asset of Senator Landrieu.
The Governor Bobby Jindal has given indication of late that he will be running for president in 2016. But if he does, he'll be running as a private citizen. Now, you represented a gentleman, Gary Hart, who did much better when he ran for president as a sitting U.S. senator than as a private citizen.
Well, we'll never know how well he would have done as a private citizen because he flamed out with a scandal. Well, as a Democrat, I sincerely want Governor Jindal to run. Just sincerely want him to run. I think it would be very good for the Democrat Party.
Well, you sound like you want him to get the nomination.
Oh, that'd be even better, but that'll never happen. But, you know, just run. Muck it up like all these guys did last time. Poor Romney, I kind of felt sorry for him coming off of a battlefield of these wannabes. So I want a lot of Republican wannabes like Governor Jindal to be in there. I think it'd be great. Now, I'm being a little unkind to him, but to be honest, that's how I feel. I don't like what he's done to my universities. I don't like what he's done to my state.
Well, Cal Thomas, a conservative columnist, he has written in print about the Louisiana miracle that Governor Jindal has presided over.
Talk to those football players at Grambling about that miracle. Talk to Northwestern State's journalism department about that miracle. Talk to even LSU. The journalism, college journalism there is remarkable what they've done. They've turned into one of the best colleges of journalism in America, despite the governor.
Does it help when a governor is from LSU? You know, Mike Foster, who we mentioned earlier, he pumped a lot of money into LSU, including the journalism school, and he was a graduate. John McKithen, graduate of LSU. Edwin Edwards, graduate of LSU. They all had this affinity for their alma mater. Jindal's from
right.
Brown. Romer was from Harvard. Blanco was from ULL. Does that matter?
You know, that's interesting. I'd never thought of it that way. In other words, you're saying they didn't have an emotional attachment to LSU. Therefore, they didn't mind slashing the system.
I didn't quite say that, but I might
have. No, you didn't say that, but I'm putting words in your mouth. I don't want to get you.
I might have implied it.
See, no one can fire me from anything, so I could say almost anything I wish, which gives me a great advantage.
No, but
you're an objective newsman. So anyway, I take back what I said.
No,
you didn't say that.
No, but I think a case could be made that when a governor has an emotional attachment to his or her alma mater, that the funding for the university perhaps will be more plentiful than it would be if, say, the governor went to a place like Brown University.
I think so, too. You know, elect me governor, I'll raise the tax on severance tax on oil a dollar a barrel, and I'll give it all to LSU. We'll make LSU the best-funded university outside of the University of Texas in America. Give me
well,
a shot. Elect me.
A listener has sent me an email noting that the governor is a U.S. citizen by virtue of the fact that his mother took a job at LSU when she was pregnant with Bobby Jindal, and that resulted in Governor Jindal being born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, making him eligible to be the 45th president of the United States.
Well, you know, I've never heard anybody say that he wasn't an American citizen. I never have even hinted at
no,
that.
But he would have been born in India, most likely, if his mother had not taken the job at LSU.
Yeah, that's true. So he does owe LSU a lot, is what we're saying. He should remember that.
Hold that thought. We'll be back with Ray Strother in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And in just a moment, we'll hear from Andrew Schlesinger, son of Arthur Schlesinger Jr. And the book, The Letters of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., is fresh out from Random House. And this is a historian like no one else in the 20th century. I'm sure Raymond Strother, our guest, has read a few missives from Andrew Schlesinger Jr.
I've met him. I once ate lunch with him.
Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Now, the remarks we were making as we went to the break, I didn't want to just let them go. We've talked about Governor Jindal running for president. You think that's an unlikely scenario as far as success? Earlier, we mentioned Edwin Edwards running for governor, and I'm sure many think that's an unlikely scenario for success. But the reality is that 2015 and 2016, Ray Strother could be a very interesting time.
It will be an interesting time. You know, first of all, a lot of things can happen between now and then. Republicans could wake up one morning and say, "Hey, we're self-destructing," and that would change things. But I don't see that on the rising just yet. You still have some wing nuts floating around in Washington. A lot of them, seems like more and more. But Hillary Clinton will more than likely, and I'm just guessing now, if I were to bet, she would be the nominee of the Democratic Party. She's a formidable candidate, and she'll have a lot of built-in advantages, ability to raise money. It takes about $1 billion now to run for president of the United States.
Isn't that something?
And she'll have the ability to raise money. She'll have name recognition and a lot of goodwill. She'll have a great woman's feminist vote. She has a lot of things going for her. So, and she'll be running against a party that works very hard to alienate all the groups she's strong with. So,
how much money did Hart spend when he ran in 84 and almost received the Democratic nomination?
We spent about $70 million, I think.
Which was a lot of money in 1984.
Yeah, it was a lot of money. After New Hampshire, we came in second. After Iowa, we came in second Iowa and then won New Hampshire. But after New Hampshire, there were people just throwing money at us. I went to in New Hampshire the morning after the election. I went to a meeting, a strategy meeting, and I got to a house and it was just surrounded by cars and there were people everywhere. And so I went to the door and this guy held up his arm and said, "You can't come in." I said, "Why?" He said, "This is a Hart meeting." I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "Well, you can't come in." So I couldn't get in the house. There were so many people, so many new friends for Hart. So I walked around the side of the house, and Pat Caddell, the pollster, pulled me in through the window. That's how I got into the Hart meeting the day after the New Hampshire election. So that's what happens. Money came then, although we never had enough, really.
All right. I did want to read one email before we part company with Ray Strother about the presidential search, and this one is from Mike Groves, the Dean Emeritus of the LSU School of Veterinary Medicine. He writes, "I don't buy the fact that donors and supporters will forsake a president or chancellor who applies for another job. In fact, it may lead to more support in an effort to keep him or her in their present position. Remember when Bill Jenkins applied for the president of the University of Florida? Not only was this common knowledge, the whole interview process could be viewed on the Internet. He did not get the job and still became one of the most respected and beloved administrators in the university's history." That from Dean Mike Groves. Thank you, sir.
And that's a man after my heart. I agree.
Well, thank you, Ray Strother. Very good to visit with you as always. And belated happy birthday. And we'll talk soon.
Well, thanks for calling. Enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org by email. And we're joined by Andrew Schlesinger, the son of Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. The book is The Letters of Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., spanning more than five decades. These words from Henry Kissinger: "Arthur Schlesinger's letters to friends and acquaintances in the highest echelons of mid-20th century political and intellectual life are vivid, candid, witty, and brilliantly written." Here's a historian, and these are my words, who is better known than many of the people he covered. How was that, Andrew, as we join you for your dear father to be more famous than many of the people that he was writing about?
Hi, Jim. Good question. I think that part of it was that he was a prominent intellectual or public intellectual over a long span, 60 years. The letters start in 1945 when he won his first Pulitzer Prize for a for The Age of Jackson, Andrew Jackson, and he was playing in the political fields until 2005. He's from Massachusetts, and he was an early supporter of John F. Kennedy was our congressman in Cambridge before he became a senator, and he was a conscience for the liberals of the Democratic Party, and we found in gathering these letters that that really his life was devoted to promoting the liberal agenda in America, and it became clear in the letters that he was pushing with all his friends and with the politicians and himself for the liberal concerns like affirmative government, public expenditure, civil rights, negotiations instead of militarization. You know, there over 60 years, you have your liberal periods and your conservative periods. So he was sometimes more popular than at other times, but he persevered. And I think that's what we were proudest to find out in this, in collecting the letters, that this was the theme of his life.
Well, he lived from 1917 to 2007. He was 89 when he died, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Won the Pulitzer for The Age of Jackson in 1946 and for 1,000 Days in 1966.
Right.
And he was not afraid, in fact, may have even relished making others who did not share his views of the world uncomfortable. That resulted in, a famous feud with William F. Buckley. What happened with those two?
Well, the funny thing is that Buckley was his bete noire, his conservative, I don't want to say enemy, but his conservative rival to my father's liberalism in the 1950s and 1960s. And they used to go around the country and debate each other about the merits of each point of view. And then over the years, they got to know each other, and they got to, calmed down a little bit about their feelings, and they became very good friends.
Is it true that Buckley once sent an unusual item to the House?
Oh yeah, back in the 1956 campaign, my father was a speechwriter and an advisor to Adlai Stevenson, who ran in 1952 and 1956, and Buckley, as a joke, sent a donkey to our house in Cambridge. It was delivered, and he think, oh yeah, he called the donkey, there was a sign on the donkey, and he called the donkey Arthur. We all thought that was pretty funny. And so I think they broke the dam between the two of them, because they were both humorous men, and quite clever. And so they had fun, in their argument, in that basic argument that defines America between the conservatives and the liberals.
The guest is Andrew Schlesinger, discussing the letters of Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. And among the letters, a half dozen to John Fitzgerald Kennedy, including one five-page single-space critique of the manuscript of Profiles in Courage.
Yeah, let me tell you about that. I found that letter at the JFK Library in Boston, and I was really excited to find it. It had never been reported in any of the books. And Kennedy had asked my father in 1955 to critique the manuscript of Profiles in Courage. And Kennedy, in his way, asked Arthur to be ruthlessly frank. And my father was certainly rigorous, if not ruthless, in his comments. But the letter and supporting correspondence reveal, I think, the beginnings of a relationship of trust and respect that helps explain their later collaboration in the White House.
And, of course, Profiles in Courage won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
Now,
it was a bit like my father was a professor. He was a teacher, and so he had critiqued many graduate students' theses and stuff like that. And I think that this letter is reproduced in the book, and it's a very detailed criticism and constructive criticism. And I think that this helps define their relationship that blossomed in the White House.
Well, he also wrote, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. did, a letter to the First Lady, Jackie Kennedy, hours after the assassination of the president.
I think that's a pretty heartbreaking letter. My father, I can look it up and maybe quote it, but my father was in New York City on the day of the assassination, that Friday, and he was in a meeting with Katharine Graham and the editors of Newsweek, and an assistant walked in and said, "The president's been shot," and this was just overwhelming, and so they flew back quickly to Washington. And my father went to the White House, and he described it as the worst day of his life. Oh, here it is, right here. He says, "Dear," and then he came home. Those are very upsetting days for any of us who were alive at the time. And he was with the family, and this is when he wrote his note to Jackie, and then later he went back to the White House, and in the middle of the night, and when the body was delivered, and conferred with Robert Kennedy about whether the cask should be opened or closed, and my father advised that it should be closed because, despite the work of the undertakers, it just did not look. It was just not a. It was not his friend, John F. Kennedy. To Jackie, he said, nothing I can say can mitigate the shame and horror of this day. Your husband was the most brilliant, able, and inspiring member of my generation. He was the one man in whom the country could confide its destiny with confidence and hope. He animated everything. He led with passion and gaiety and wit. To have known him and worked with him, with and for him, is the most fulfilling experience I have ever had or could imagine. Dearest Jackie, the love and grief of a nation may do something to suggest the feeling of terrible vacancy and despair we all feel. Marion and my weeping children join me in sending you our profoundest love and sympathy. I know that you will let me know when I can do anything to help. With abiding love, Arthur.
Was it handwritten?
Yes, it was handwritten.
That would be a rarity today, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think so. All his papers are at the New York Public Library in Manhattan, and I guess they have the original copy of this letter, but I think it sums up his feelings about the president and Jackie Kennedy, who he had found when he first met her in 1959 to be a very intelligent lady and not the... let's see, I have something about this right here.
I know these letters, they go up almost until the day that Arthur Schlesinger Jr. took his last breath. He kept writing, and he not only wrote words of praise, but as you say, he could be critical, and he could be critical of people from the left.
He did.
He didn't like Christopher Hitchens too much, did he?
No, he didn't. Well, Christopher Hitchens turned right when he, in his latter part of his life, and he attacked Arthur as a Kennedy courtier and someone who was making excuses for the Kennedys, and protecting them. But this was something that my father became a target for people from both the left and the right. And let me tell you one more funny sort of letter. He did have friends among the Republicans, and he did feel that personal relations should not be totally dictated by politics. And I like this exchange that I found between Arthur and the Republican Senator Phil Gramm of Texas in 1992.
Okay.
After my father received a Republican solicitation in the mail signed by Gramm, my father wrote back, "I am touched by your letter of 20 February in which you kindly say that you are holding open a roundtable membership for me. For $5,000 per annum, you promised me a host of special benefits denied ordinary American citizens, including private briefings, hospitality suites, passes to lavish galas and dinners, and even a discourse by Dan Quayle on world trade. Such rare treats. It gives me great comfort to know that the roundtable computer is as incompetent as the rest of the Republican administration." But Gramm gave as good as he got. He wrote back, "Dr. Schlesinger, thank you for your thoughtful letter. Please be assured that no mistake was made inviting you to support the Republican Party. We believe in redemption."
Well, he also had a friendship with Henry Kissinger that some might find unusual.
Yes, that's true. But he knew Henry Kissinger from 1951, when Henry Kissinger was at Harvard University. And they were both at Harvard in the 50s. And actually, my father thought that Henry was quite brilliant then. And he gave a foot up to Kissinger in introducing him to people in the foreign policy establishment.
What about Lauren Bacall? How did he know her?
Well, Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart were great liberals in the late 40s and 50s, early 50s. And Lauren Bacall was enchanted by Adlai Stevenson, so my father got to know them back in the 1952 campaign. Politics can bring you in touch with people from all different bodies of life. And my father has had a certain number of close friends in the movies or in Broadway who basically liberal Democrats who became his friends, and Lauren Bacall remained a friend, and I met her some many times and got to know her too, and she's a very impressive lady.
Well, Andrew, we've got a roll, but thank you so much, Andrew Schlesinger, an amazing man. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. His letters are available from Random House. And we'll return tomorrow with Kevin Gallagher as producer, as he is today. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.